Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, August 20th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuc hosted. She was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Bob Griffin, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
Lots to talk about today, as every day. I wanted to get specifically all of your opinions, but specifically Bob's opinion on the recent conversations in Alaska and D.C. yesterday with the Coalition of the Willing regarding the Russo-Ukraine war. As we know, members of the Coalition of the Willing have been meeting in D.C. after the summit between President Donald Trump and President Vladimir Putin in Alaska last week. Just some comments on recent events from our Homeland Security, et cetera, specialist.
It's grim. What's both heartening and disheartening at the same time is watching other world leaders, folks that I would have categorized as long-term allies of ours, where we were in lockstep on foreign policy, actually moving away from the United States. That's the bad part of it. The fact that our leadership globally, I think, has suffered significant and it's harm that can be repaired, Sarah, but it's going to take a long time to rebuild trust. The bad part is, the good part is that they're supporting Ukraine and continuing to show at least a modicum of support for what is occurring in the Ukraine against the Russian aggression, but there's just a big gap. I've been looking at a lot of articles about how the Ukraine military has had to change how it's approaching the war, how Russia has increased the severity in targeting of civilian populations as they think. And unfortunately, I think it was confirmed by Trump that we're backing out on our commitment to the Ukraine. So I see that whole situation as sort of both a positive in the sense that if I was as a supporter of the Ukraine, I'm glad to see that there are people who are strong enough to come out and say, even in the face of Trump's bullying, no, we're going to stand on the side of what is right and what is just. I question, where is this country? Where are we going with our foreign policy? Frankly, I was embarrassed by what I saw out of Alaska. I was embarrassed by the symbolism. We got played as a country. We looked much weaker than we should have. The relationship between Putin and Trump is one that is of enormous concern because of the practices that Trump admires that Putin used. And I think as we talk about some of the other issues today, whether it's the use of the military in our cities, whether it's the abject cruelty of an administration who is spending a lot of time figuring out how to be even crueler, these are all sort of, in my mind, symptoms of movement of government towards totalitarianism and authoritarianism that we need, as a country, need to stand up against.
Nick or Teresa, any questions, comments, feedback on the?
Yeah, I echoing what Bob said, I think that it was a real yet more evidence of the Trump team, and I wouldn't say we. I think we have to say it's the Trump team. I understand it's on behalf of our country, but this has to be laid on them and on the Republicans in Congress who enable it and who continue the funding of it and don't put any checks, because the Republicans in the Congress could put some checks on what's happening, and they're not doing it. But I think that it was a real sign. And if you listen to historians, diplomats, generals who talked about it, there was a chorus of consensus, and even in Fox News, of it being a display of weakness and a display of concern, what the Trump and his team did. From what was talked about, but even, I mean, there was a lot of talk about the finding the documents in a hotel office, you know,
right, on a printer.
Business office on a printer. That's not a small thing, to be honest with you. That's because if these folks don't understand the seriousness of the situation and that they are so untrained that they use a public computer and a public printer in these highly classified, some people say it's just a memo. Well, it was a memo, but a menu. It was that and much more. It's just a level of lack of understanding of the seriousness and a focus on performance and not a focus on substance. And it has carried over into the follow-on talk about, you know, from the Trump on down, his commerce folks, and why are they not the diplomats talking, saying, oh, now the next step is we have to have a meeting with Putin and Ukraine. And no, what the leaders, what we need to have is the hard work of their people, the diplomats, the generals, the military folks talking to work out some sort of a detail. They're skipping the governing part. It's a lot like Trump just signing executive orders and think that's governing. That's not doing the hard work of governing. And again, you see it across the board. And it really weakens the U.S. standing in the world. And I do think that you did see some evidence of the importance of the foundation of the President Biden did in terms of pulling together the coalition, the NATO coalition, because they really have come to the rescue. And it was so important, them essentially inviting themselves to the White House, saying they were coming. And I think that that show of support and saying that they were not going to let Zelensky come alone and be subject to what he was the last time. But that's a terrific display of the power of the NATO coalition. But also, it's a really damning comment on Trump and his team's approach to this, that they feel that they needed to do that. And Trump was talking about how historic it was. It was, but in a really concerning way. And I think that they just, you know, we had been the leader of the free world. And I think that they're just not operating at that level at across the board, whether it's on the tariff negotiations, whether it's on budget negotiations, whether it's on Ukraine or what's happening in Gaza, which I think the reporters have to go back to asking what's happening in Gaza, because it's continuing to get worse. People are continuing to starve. And now you hear the reports today, the ongoing reports of the Israelis' plans to move over a million people into a settlement area and then eventually out of the country in a year-long additional offensive there. And these are funded with our dollars. I mean, there's a lot of deeply unsettling things going on. And China's watching, folks. China's watching.
Nick?
Yeah, so just to circle back on the sort of the meeting with Russia and with Ukraine and allies, I think what stands out to me is the lack of expertise and experience, right, and the depth or the lack thereof, depth of knowledge of the team that is staffing the U.S. president in both those conversations, those negotiations, and in international diplomacy. And I think that's a reflection on this backlash against deep state, if you will, the notion that deep knowledge and expertise is somehow a barrier to creative problem solving, right? And the notion that the people who have been career diplomats, career negotiators, career political thinkers and political thought leaders have been purged from this administration and from DC and from our agencies, our the agencies that are supposed to be able to keep us safe. And the fact is that lack of information, lack of knowledge means that then we rely on something else. And what we relied on in this instance was a performative image in which we did not have enough information to bring a real option or real solutions to the table, but instead rolled out the red carpet, had a military presence, had the media there to make Putin look good, allowed Putin to take his wins, which was a photograph with the president and these images where the president is looking less than the machismo image that he's accustomed to being presented as. And that is, you know, it is that there was this embarrassment because of how poorly many people think the meeting went with President Putin, but also just we have to recognize that it went poorly because there's not a depth of expertise there who could have made it go differently.
Or wouldn't have set it up in the first place because progress was unlikely to occur. It does not seem like Putin will.
Well, what's the goal? I mean, this is you're hitting, ever. I think, part of my frustration. What's the goal of this? And right. And in the back of my mind, the goal is Trump's desire to get a Nobel Peace Prize, regardless of what is right, just, or correct, both for our country but also for the Ukraine. And the history that I see with this guy is that it's always about him. So I'm looking at this from a lens of, am I opposed to the peace in the Ukraine? No, I'm not opposed at all. But the idea that somehow we are going to be party to strong-arming the Ukraine to give up more territory, you know, which frankly we did. I mean, when Russia moved into Crimea, and even before that, you know, part of the Ukraine giving up its nuclear stockpile, its deterrent factor is that there was a global promise of support should there be aggression from Russia. Again, what is the purpose of this? You're right, Nick. He legitimized Putin, and he legitimized Putin is weak right now. There's a number of internal issues in Russia, and Trump made him look stronger than he was. And I think he also diminished the Ukraine by the way he's handled the situation. And on a personal note, this has nothing to do with peace or the peace efforts, but the fact that the White House has been turned into sort of an example of modern day brothels is just horrifying to me. I look at the pictures of the gilding that I equate more with the palaces of Versailles than I do with the people's house, and all of these are just little changes of how Trump and the whole movement has warped what we thought about democracy in this country. The point that Teresa and Nick make, though, if I could go back to, because it's really important, we've hollowed out the expertise of this country.
Right.
Okay, we have taken away the idea that this is a meritocracy, and we have gone back to that this is a spoiled system. And the other part of it, and I don't know if we're going to get to be able to talk about the black fence on the border, painting the fence, because it'll be hotter. We have a group of people now in the highest elements of our government who are incompetent and cruel. And they're spending way more time on the cruelty of government than they are in the how to make the country better. And if you've ever asked yourself the question of how did Nazi Germany, devolve into what it was in carrying out the one of the largest mass murders in the history of the world, it was because people not only followed what the leadership said, they amplified it. And what we don't spend a lot of time talking about is the amplification of the move towards authoritarianism by people in the administration and driving out. And I don't know if we're going to talk about Tulsi Gabbard's use of taking away security clearances as a way of firing people because they had the audacity to tell the truth. These stories all hang together in a really grim direction.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Russ writes in and says, it's disheartening to hear the talk of security guarantees for Ukraine. Russia will never allow foreign troops to occupy its renegade province, but would rather mobilize the country in a, quote, patriotic war to repel, quote, the invaders. That from Russ. We are discussing the Russian-Ukraine war and the meetings that have happened recently about that. Diane writes in and says, leading a company is not governing a country, especially in the United States, supposed leader of the free world. When you are standing on a stage with the leader of the Soviet Union looking like you're ready to take a nap, it is such a sad state of affairs. Thank God for incredible countries and leaders of those countries who are standing strong with Ukraine. The administration has no idea what they're doing, and unfortunately, it looks like they truly don't care if the bigger picture, let alone the issues at hand. Nick? You don't have to respond to the letter, but you wanted to say something before the break.
Yeah, I guess only so much as kind of hearkening back to our earlier discussion about just the lack of expertise in the White House on these issues. Steve Witkoff is a real estate attorney, and he is the leading envoy and negotiator for peace talks, or I'm air quoting peace talks, between Russia and Ukraine and the United States. And I just... I think that sets us up, that lack of experience in that space specifically sets us up for making these missteps that just shouldn't happen on the national stage as the United States of America.
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, August 20th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, August 21st, Joe was joined by Preceptor in Public Speaking, Strategic Communications, and Public Relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, Grants Analyst, Emily Honan, and Mayor of the City of Albany, Kathy Sheehan.
All right, let's start and talk about what is going on in this big old world of ours. And we'll start with Texas gerrymandering and sort of a two-part story. We can take this separately, but I'll give you both headlines and we can start with Texas. Texas Republicans are poised to pass the new redistricting maps. You'll remember all the Democrats left the state for a long time to try to put off this vote for as long as possible. And now they're back and the state Senate will vote Thursday on maps. That's today. To help the GOP with five more U.S. House seats in the midterm elections. California Democrats will counter on the same day, and we'll talk a little bit about California in a few moments. The Texas House passed an aggressively partisan congressional map on Wednesday after weeks of legislative combat, giving President Trump and the gerrymander he requested, and possibly five new Republican seats in the U.S. House next year. After more than 8 hours of at times tense and emotional debate, the final vote, 88-52, fell squarely along party lines. It capped bitterly partisan political wrangling with a Democratic walkout and Republican retaliation and set off a redistricting fever that has spread from Austin to Sacramento to right here in Albany, New York. Terry, I'll let you start off on this.
Well, the battle has begun. I think you're going to see every state in the country debate whether there's a way to do this or not, regardless of what party currently holds the majority. And I think that there's no way out of it at this point. We're in a situation where our democracy is really very much at stake. And those who want to fight for freedom and justice have really no choice at this point but to try to get as many members of the Democratic Party elected as possible in Congress so that we have some power again, so that we can begin to put some checks and balances on a system right now which has very little. I know that there will be many on both sides of this issue that will debate whether it's right or wrong, and I think those are all valid arguments. One of the things that I find interesting is that the Democratic Party, for the most part in various states, has dealt with redistricting in a way where it has essentially been turned over to the voters. A referendum of some sort from the voters is often needed to finalize the redistricting in terms of how Democrats have set it up in the past. But when Republicans have had control of the redistricting process, they have often set it up where voters don't necessarily have a say-so in it, and that's what's going on in Texas. So it's interesting how the Democratic Party has tried to be the party of the people, and here we are now in a situation where it's going to be a little bit harder for Democrats to get the redistricting done. It's a little bit easier for Republicans to do it in places where the voters don't have a say-so in it, like Texas. But still, I think that we haven't even begun to see the end of this. It's just beginning. I think you will see districts change in multiple states, both red and blue, and it's going to be close. It's going to be a close election, as we always knew it would be.
Mayor.
Well, you know, I think that given the court rulings on this, it's interesting that Texas is being so blatantly partisan about it. And I think that's to deflect from the impact of this redistricting on race. And it sounds like the Democrats are going to sue over the maps based on that. But they have said over and over again, we redo these so that we could have more Republican districts. And so they're very straightforward about what they're doing. And again, this is as a result of the Supreme Court decision that said you can be political about how you create these districts. You just can't be racist about it. And so they have gone at this very openly and directly. And I don't know that any challenge of these maps will be successful or even that it will play out before the midterm elections next year.
Emily?
Yeah, and I think that the timing is something that I've thought a lot about. I mean, I've talked about this before, but Democrats keep trying to go about this in, you know, the dutiful way, the lawful way. You know, we have the voter referendums and everything, and we're dealing with people who are either not playing by the rules or they're just making up new rules to suit them. And it's very easy for, you know, the Texas Republicans to do this because they know that they have the support of an executive branch that's steadily growing in power, where at this point I'm not sure if anything can combat it. And they know that they're allowed to do whatever they want, and they're going to do it, and they're going to be blatant about it. And it's going to be, even though it's very true that it's racist, it's going to be difficult to prove that, and it's definitely not going to happen on a time frame that's feasible.
I was struck, Terry, by something you said about both sides, you know, argue over this. I mean, I think there does seem to be somewhat of a consensus that there are members of both parties that say that this isn't the way it should be done, but this is the way that they're going to have to do it to, quote, fight fire with fire. But it does seem, and I know this is probably a naive statement, but it does seem like we can come up with a fair system that actually cannot be manipulated as easy as it seems that it's being manipulated now.
I'm not so sure about that. Having spent time myself and having spent time myself in a state legislature that redrew the maps when I was there, I'm just not sure about that. I think ultimately, when you turn a system over to politicians to make the decisions, there's always going to be a few in that group. They're going to find a way to manipulate it. And it's just the nature of how the game is played, regardless of what party you're in. And because so much power is at stake and so many important decisions are at stake. And this is a time where I think I personally have to support hoping that Democrats will do whatever they can to redraw districts and states so that we can combat this, because I don't see that we have any other choice at this point in time, knowing full well that it's not an ideal situation. It's not a completely fair situation. But there are lots of things within our democracy and even in our Constitution that still just aren't fair that we need to continue to work on. To Mayor Sheehan's point, that the Supreme Court, in their last ruling on gerrymandering, essentially gave states permission to do this. And so the Supreme Court is part of our Constitution. They have made the decision that it's okay for states to do this. So states are doing it. And the only way to fix this is to get – the only way to really fix it would be to get Democrats elected to all houses, the Senate and the House, and to the presidential office, and then have them pass some type of new law that would change how we draw districts. But the idea of doing that seems really far-fetched at this point. I will say this. I hope, if nothing else comes of this, I hope that the American people finally begin to understand how important state government is. Because I know that when I was in state government, one of the things that was just constantly frustrating was how little people knew about it, how little they cared about it, how disconnected they were with it. I haven't seen that's changed much lately. But we're seeing now, as this president begins to really downsize, destroy ultimately what our federal government used to look like, we really are left with just 50 state governments that are really making the majority of the really big decisions that affect our lives every day. And the people that we elect in these states to represent us have an enormous amount of power over our lives. And this redistricting process is pointing to that right now. And I hope it's a wake-up call to those who want to try to defend our democracy and hope they get more involved in state races.
Okay. Yeah, and I think, you know, Terry, you know, to your point, I think that Democrats want us to fight. They want Democrats to show that they're going to punch back. And so being nice about this and talking about how it should be and giving people, you know, making this a truly independent process, I don't think that there's any appetite among Democrats for this. I think that they want California to gerrymander the hell out of their districts, and they'd love to see New York and any other state that can potentially do this before the midterms to do it. And that is why I think we've got to, as Democrats, come up with a message on this. I think we're going to talk about it, but former President Obama came out in favor of doing this, and I think that Democrats want us to fight, and if we don't, I think that we'll have a much more difficult time, notwithstanding the gerrymandering going on, winning hearts and minds in the midterms next year.
And Terry mentioned this, but you still have New York. We won't get this done in time in New York, right? For the midterms?
Well, I mean, the way that the system is set up, it would be difficult to do that, but I would never say never. I mean, this president has done things that we never thought could be done, and they're happening, and the courts are not stepping in, and so I wouldn't rule anything out, and I'm sure that the governor and the leaders of our Senate and Assembly are talking about this. I hope they're talking about it right now.
I think it's
I think that I'm sorry. I think the governor Hochul is going to take action on this, and I think all the governors in Democratic states are gonna push the legal limits, just as President Trump has pushed the legal limits on this, to go as far as they possibly can to see what they can get away with, because that's the only way we're gonna win this fight. It's just gonna have to be fire with fire.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's really sad and unfortunate that Trump has essentially forced, you know, people into this situation of sort of skewing democracy in the exact same way that he is. But honestly, it's been a long time coming. I wish it had happened sooner. My favorite TikTok for a while has been a guy saying, like, Democrats, whenever Trump passes a new version of the You Will All Suffer Act, and they're like, newsflash, that's unconstitutional. And, you know, they start waving. And it's just, that's what they've been doing, in my opinion, for a while. They're like, well, wait a minute, he can't do that. And he can. He's laid bare the very flimsy foundations on which the country is built. The Supreme Court and all these branches are just, if someone has the drive like Trump does right now, he can, you know, destroy it, essentially.
Mayor Sheehan brought up, which was a story that I wanted to touch on. Of course, we were talking about Texas, but we did also mention California and what is going on in California. What also is happening there is the former president of the United States, Barack Obama, came out yesterday and is supporting redistricting, saying the GOP can't, quote, rig the game. The former president said that what Texas Republicans are doing requires an equally aggressive response from Democrats, which is much of what we've been talking about so far this morning. Texas's proposed map could create at least 5 additional Republican safe districts, and California's push, framed as something akin to a trigger law, would create a similar number of additional Democratic-leaning districts as a countermeasure as the parties battle for control of the narrowly divided House next year. Obama said that what Texas Republicans are doing requires an equally aggressive response from Democrats. But in the long term, the former president told those gathered at the National Democratic Redistricting Committee fundraiser, there should be no political gerrymandering in America. So how do you do that, Mayor Sheehan?
Well, I don't know that we've ever had that. And I think, you know, when districts are drawn, there are a number of factors that are taken into consideration. But I think that the underlying message of we have to fight back is what Democrats need to be focused on. When we talk about these ideals and when we talk about how things should be, I do think that people are losing their patience. They want to see action, and they want us to fight for our democracy. They want us to fight for government that actually is focused on solving the challenges and the problems that we are facing. And I look at what the Republicans are doing in Texas, and it says a lot that the first thing they did when the Democrats came back was take this up, as opposed to starting with the legislation that they are working on to respond to the horrific flooding and the devastation that occurred in Texas. And that's part of the reasons that the Democrats came back. It was indefensible that they weren't there to be able to take action to help those areas that have been ravaged by the floods. But the Republicans are telling us what their values are by saying, we're going to do this first, and then we'll get to the flood relief. And I understand why, right? Because if they did the flood stuff first, the Democrats would just walk out. I get it. But that's where we are. And we are in a hyper partisan place in this country. And unless Democrats respond accordingly, we are going to be in the minority for, I think, a very, very long time.
Yeah. And also, I mean, Obama's sort of, you know, no more of this. You know, this is the last time. You know, that kind of reminds me of how we got into this whole mess in the first place, which is because, you know, we were essentially just told, well, don't have political parties. So, you know, that's not accounted for in our Constitution, which is why we don't have, you know, a system where we can have a third party or anything like that, because we just automatically fall into these two very partisan, you know, sort of points of view. It's very kind of sad to hear that from him, just very naive almost. I'm not really sure what he was going for there. I think maybe a stronger word would say we can't let the executive branch push us into this situation, which is what's been happening. And we need to have more checks and balances in place to ensure that it doesn't. But right now, we can't worry about all that. We don't have the luxury of trying to be right. Fair in an unfair world.
And fighting the fire with fire. Terry.
I think one of my concerns is that the Democratic Party is relying on a former president who is, to this new generation of voters coming up, really not that well known and whose credibility is in question. It points to a weakness in the party, and that we still don't really have that spokesperson, that face, that personality, that dynamic personality that can really compete with Donald Trump and really excite voters, really get voters to pay attention and get them engaged. We need to find that person desperately, urgently, now. We need that person to step forward. Maybe it's multiple people. There are people that are trying to do this. It's not that we don't have people trying, but we're missing that. And what we are also missing, or what we have been missing for decades now, is a Democratic president, when we did have one, that got as involved in state politics as Donald Trump has gotten involved. Donald Trump has seen the power that exists in state legislatures. He's gotten involved. He has used his power and his leverage to get them to do things for him. That's what's happening now. We haven't really seen a Democratic president take that kind of power in the past. And it's one of the reasons the Democratic Party is now weaker than it should be. They haven't gotten as involved in state races as they should have. And it's all coming back now to really bite Democrats. And a lot of weaknesses are being shown because of this. So this is not the time to think about what is necessarily right and wrong. It's the time to think about what needs to be done to save this democracy. And that's going to require a different mindset and a different form of aggression and a different form of, being assertive than Democrats have had in the past. You know, there was a time not that long ago during Biden's first term where we had the House of Representatives, we had the Senate, we had all the power we needed to put so many rules and regulations in place to really stop any of what we're experiencing now from happening, and we didn't do it. There were so many of us that were really pushing them to take aggressive action and pass new laws, to pack the Supreme Court, to take radical steps like that, and we could have done it. We didn't do any of it. And here we are now, just wide open with very few defense mechanisms. And the only thing we really have is the people. We have the people that can rise up and put a stop to this. And hopefully we'll see that happen.
I think one big problem with the Democratic Party is just that it's not very cohesive. It's very fractured. There are huge, you know, striations between, you know, the younger members of the party and the older. There are a lot of differing opinions. Some people might think, oh, Bernie Sanders or maybe, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez could be that, you know, spokesperson. But there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who would really oppose that. And I think that's the issue. It's the lack of cohesion. I mean, Trump was, you know, sort of a uniting factor. He got all of these talking points that really united Republicans, and unfortunately the Democrats are just too fractured right now. They've never, that was where Hillary sort of faltered. She never really got the youth vote. I think that that's sort of a weak spot of the Democratic Party as a whole. I think that that's where a lot of that weakness comes from.
Yeah, I certainly think that we're struggling on the national level to find that authentic person. I mean, say what you want about Donald Trump. He is authentic and he's unapologetic, and he has been able to coalesce people to do things that we all thought no one would ever do, that at some point people who love this country and love our democracy would say that's a bridge too far, and that hasn't happened. But I think that the other thing that we need to start talking about is taking the ref out of the game, right? So, I think that we've got to recognize that this is happening in Texas, and then what are the Democrats going to do about it? We should fight for every single one of those seats. I mean, you know, we can't just throw up our hands and say, oh, gerrymandering, it's impossible, because, you know, we now are facing a new reality. And I think that what I hope Democrats in Texas are doing is, you know, looking at who they're going to run for these congressional seats in these new districts. And we should fight like hell to win the hearts and minds of the voters and win those seats. And so that probably sounds hopelessly naive. I'm not in Texas. I don't know all of the dynamics of that. But this is the reality that we're facing. And I think that we should be focusing on what do we have to do to win back the Congress, no matter what the Republicans try to throw at that. And I do think that there is a desire among young people, a desire among Democratic voters across the spectrum to just say, okay, let's fight for these. Let's get this done. What do we have to do? And how do we mobilize to win these seats?
That was Kathy Sheehan on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, August 21st. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, August 22nd, Joe was joined by former EPA Regional Administrator, Professor at Bennington College and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Siena University Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti.
All right, so here we go. The FBI is searching the Maryland home of ex-Trump advisor John Bolton. You remember John Bolton. FBI agents were searching his home. President Trump's former national security advisor, who is now a frequent critic of the president. In fact, I saw him on CNN just 2 days ago talking about maybe 3 days ago when Zelensky was the day after Zelensky was in town. And I thought, well, this, you know, obviously, he was very outspoken that day, as he has been. And then I'm not saying that one is connected to the other, but my point being that he has continued to be an outspoken critic and is now going to dealing with them going through his home in the FBI. The details are limited as far as what they are looking for, but it believes those who have spoken say that it is focused on whether Bolton illegally possessed or shared classified information. Right?
The irony.
Right?
I mean,
the
just
book's only been
the
out
irony.
For what? How many years?
I mean,
stored in his bathroom.
Yes.
A lot of gold.
Yeah. So he's this is all taking place in Bethesda, Maryland. And so we look at this. I have to say that on my bingo card of people that the president may go after for retaliation, John Bolton was not on it. I just thought he was sort of out of that fray. However, obviously not the case with the investigation into his activities. And Jim, what do you make of it?
What do I make of it? Well, you know, I mean, I would never, ever accuse the current administration of hypocrisy of any kind. And, you know, we all know that President Trump would never have ever taken any kind of classified information and handled it inappropriately and showed it to the Russians and revealed, you know, national security plans to people who, you know, I would be thrown in prison forever if I did. But, you know, yeah, so clearly, apparently, Bolton's 2020 book, which has only been out for 5 years, may have had some things in it that, quote, were not properly vetted, although they were vetted. And, gee, maybe he has something in his house that he shouldn't have, unlike, you know, anyone else. So it's just, you know, when it was being done against a former president who will remain nameless, that former president defined it as a witch hunt. did everything possible to delay and made sure that it went into the jurisdiction of somebody who happened to have been appointed by that. And now it's like, oh, no, I never did anything wrong. And look, Bolton might have told a secret. I mean, it's just the transparency of the excuses. Right.
Because there have been other excuses in the past. I mean, trying the Trump administration's attempt to delay publication. There was his having his security clearance revoked as, I mean, what, within the first month?
Yes.
Of the terms. So this isn't the first attempt to go after Bolton.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, well, when the first two didn't accomplish the desired outcome, now we bring in the sledgehammer. And I think what this shows is, in a larger picture, what I call the mafia theory of the state, where the government is run like organized crime, and it governs by intimidation, it governs by fear, and for those that are not loyal or willing to just toe the party line and do what, and pun totally intended with this, to do what the Don says, they're going to face consequences. And the consequences are going to be, you know, they're not going to get whacked, but they're going to face extremely long court battles. They're going to be subject to having their home searched. They're going to be subject to having their family investigated. And it's really just a warning signal to anyone who dares to be critical that if you do, you're going to face consequences. So it's, you know, it's the sign of what an autocracy looks like.
This is why I half jokingly said it's the end of summer and the end of democracy, because that's certainly what this feels like. I'm not a real big fan of John Bolton or Michael Bolton. But the thing.
John or Michael. But no relation, but still.
And so let me be cautious for a nanosecond. We don't know what the federal magistrate based their decision on allowing for this search. But the magistrate would be making the decision based on information provided by Kash Patel's FBI and Pam Bondi's Department of Justice. Neither of them are credible, independent public servants. In fact, Kash Patel already posted on social media this morning saying no one is above the law, which is hysterical coming from this administration. So as Aaron mentioned, Trump does not like John Bolton, mostly about his book, The Room Where It Happened. Probably sales will go up today. Now, the thing is, when you write a book about your experience in the federal government, you don't just write it and hire a publicist and issue it. It is read by multiple attorneys inside the White House at Department of Justice. They signed off on what was in this book. And in January, when he first took office, not only did Trump remove national security clearance for Bolton, but he also took away his protective detail. And the reason why he has a protective detail, you recall in the first term, he and Trump were very engaged in Iran, and Bolton has constant death threats against him. He's right. Hired his own security firm. So I just think, yeah, the details are really important. Who knows what Bolton may or may not have in his house. But if it's about the book, it was already vetted. I think we would be naive to think that this wasn't about Trump getting back at him and what I call the show. OK, the Trump show is what this is all about. And ratings are low in late August.
And a good conversation going on the items in the news for today, which includes the FBI searching the home of former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton. Now, this happened shortly after 7 a.m. this morning, and FBI agents swarmed the house of Bolton. the houses in Bethesda, Maryland. As Judith mentioned, sort of go back, and I'll throw this back to her because I had to
rudely interrupt.
Exactly, rudely interrupt. Very to hurt. Go to the to go to business. But the investigations that makes him the latest of Trump's political enemies to find themselves targeted by Justice Department probe. In recent months, federal investigators have launched criminal investigations into Trump critics, including New York Attorney General Letitia James, Senator Adam Schiff, and former FBI Director James Comey, and, as the Washington Post puts it, and many others.
Yeah, I mean, this is why this is so alarming, putting John Bolton and the singer Michael Bolton aside. This is really an erosion of democracy and such an overreach of executive power. And I also think it's part of what I call the show. Trump is an entertainer. Ratings are down at the end of August. Plus, he wants to distract from the Epstein files, which, by the way, today, Department of Justice is finally delivering, I think, some of the files to the Congressional Investigative Committee.
With names redacted.
Right. So. To protect the innocent.
Right,
exactly. So, you know, I was thinking recently, as Trump tries to deflect from the Epstein files, we're going to see more and more dramatic actions by him. And that's what we're seeing. Last night, he went out. He said he was going to patrol the streets of militarized Washington, D.C. No, he was behind a fence at a secure facility handing out cold pizza to these poor National Guard folks patrolling in the heat of Washington, D.C., who knows what they're doing, but nothing particularly productive. So I think the closer that people get to revealing what's in the Epstein files, we're going to see even a greater escalation of events. Now, I think, you know, John Bolton is not on Trump's holiday card list. You know, they're not friends. But I also think Bolton has been correctly very critical of Putin in Ukraine. And that's a sore spot for Trump. And I think that's also a big motivating factor here. And it's just a terrible day for our democracy.
Bolton's very hawkish on foreign policy.
Yeah, at least.
So, you know, I'm one. I've said this before. There's probably a lot of very mainstream Republicans who agree with Bolton, but they do so privately and because they know what they have to do to, you know, maintain the good graces of
dear leader.
Of dear leader. So it's not like Bolton's a saint. I think in any, like if, you know, Bolton was in the Bush administration, we'd be coming down on him so hard about his views towards what we should be doing in Iraq and the Middle East more broadly. But in this case, I find myself scratching my head because in this topsy-turvy world where up is down and black is white, you know, I find myself coming to sympathize with people that under normal circumstances I would be 100% opposed. I'm not a foreign policy expert. I don't know where Bolton stands, but I can tell you it's probably not where, you know, the mainstream Democrats stand. So, it's, you know, it's the same thing with Jerome Powell and the Fed. I mean, Jerome Powell is a Trump appointee. He is not a radical leftist Marxist economist leading the Fed. He's a pretty conservative economist who's fairly anti-regulation and supervision when it comes to the financial industry. But here I am coming to his rescue. I'm reading Wall Street Journal editorials, finding myself saying, well, I think they're right. So when you find yourself agreeing with people that you would normally be opposed to, it's a sign that the world's just got shaken and normal or political, economic, and social orders are starting to rupture.
I'm going to say something probably fairly obvious, but I just want to illustrate, I think, the point that we try to make and often make on this program again and again. But every night before, usually between 9 and 10 o'clock, I put together a docket of stories that I send out to our panelists. And they're suggestions and nothing more. They're just ideas. And the panelists often help me. They send me ideas and we go through. And at that moment, before I go to bed, these are the ideas that we have for the morning show. Doesn't mean we'll get to all of them. May not get to any of them, but that's the idea. So we're all on the same page and have some reference point. But to your point, here were the four stories that we were that I had on the docket. Judge orders alligator Alcatraz to be dismantled. Newsom signing the California redistricting plan. The Fed and the taking on the Fed by the Trump administration. And then in one of the odder stories that I do hope we get to about the Trump administration having a stake in Intel. So, yeah. And then you and then this comes up and we end up talking about that for however many minutes, which I think you have to. And I do think it's important for all of the very good points that you made. But it does push all that other stuff off to the side, at least momentarily.
Yep. That's the point. I mean, when right. you look at that at a macro level, the
well,
point
I'm saying, it works.
Yeah, right. It does. Yeah.
Yeah. It works.
Well, and you know, I was just listening to Judith and you know, I am not exactly a literary scholar or anything like that, but, you know, I could not help thinking about Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, which has the line, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Because that's what I think this is really all about, is that you're seeing, you know, the Trump administration is becoming this centrifugal force that's pushing the left wing further left and the right wing further right. And literally this whole thing in the middle, which is where, you know, I would have put myself as middle left once upon a time. Now I'm a radical, right?
Welcome and, to the
but,
tribe.
But yeah. on the Democratic, but it's, but in the Democratic Party, I'm still seen as an old traditional, you know, and you're like, but
which know, is why Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries can't navigate our current
right.
political environment.
Yeah.
And I think the lesson is you just kind of need to know what your bottom line is. And I think yeah. for many, it's you should not weaponize the federal government.
But yeah. serious question just for what you said, and maybe a slight tangent, probably is. But Jeffries and Schumer, it is... There are people out there who probably could navigate that.
Yes, of course. But it's not these two guys.
Right. Well, that's the point. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. It's not like it's beyond anybody. It just seems to be what the strategy that has been employed by these two Democratic leaders does not seem to be of what is needed at the moment.
They are not nimble. They are not quick. They're not reading the room. For instance, all politics is local. Zohran Mamdani won the Democratic nomination for mayor in New York City. Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, Gillibrand, Governor Hochul, none of them have endorsed what the voters selected as their nominee. Similar stuff going on around the country. And you know, it's really unfortunate. The Times had a piece earlier this week how the Democratic Party is falling behind on voter registrations, on fundraising. If you want a two-party system, you have to have a viable second party. Elon Musk says he's not going to form a third party. Lots of independents out there. But I don't think the Democrats are meeting the moment, and that's why you know, Gavin Newsom is so high profile. I mean, I enjoy his social media and memes just like the next political junkie, but it's like so kind of weird and basic, and that's all you got from the Democrats.
That was Judith Enck on the Roundtable panel on Friday, August 22nd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.